This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So there's clearly a relationship between the Paris Agreement and the Clean Power Plan, but it's not as simple an answer as now this sort of throws the entire thing up in the air.
Remember the Paris Climate Agreement, when it looked for a moment like world leaders were actually going to address our shared global concern? Well, last week, the U.S. Supreme Court, in an unprecedented move, granted a stay to the utility companies in 27 states who had filed suit to halt the Obama administration's linchpin environmental legislation, the EPA's Clean Power Plan. The stay posed a threat to the recent Paris Climate Agreement. But then, over the weekend, things took a dramatic turn with the death of the Supreme Court's arch-conservative, Antonin Scalia. So what does it all mean for U.S. climate policy? Joining us this week on Sea Change Radio to make sense of the complexities of these court proceedings is environmental law expert Alex Camacho, a professor at the University of California at Irvine. He describes the implications of the stay and explains how Scalia's passing does and does not affect this decision by the court. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Alex Camacho. He's a professor of law at the University of California at Irvine. Alex, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much, Alex. I appreciate it.
It's been a very busy week on the Supreme Court, and I wanted you to explain first for our listeners what the Clean Power Plan stay was from earlier last week, what that meant, and how that's changed since the court has been transformed with the passing of Justice Antonin Scalia.
So the Clean Power Plan was challenged in the in federal court. It has made its way to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals will be looking at the case substantively, whether to overturn or uphold the Clean Power Plan. The D.C. Circuit was petitioned for a stay by the states who were challenging the rule. The D.C. Circuit unanimously, the panel of three judges, unanimously decided not to grant the stay. They then sought what's called an interlocutory appeal, sort of while before the substantive decision was made, they appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which heard the stay and in an unprecedented fashion, to quite a surprise to most experts on the Supreme Court, they did grant the stay, a 5-4 decision, where the five Republican appointees granted the stay to the states and the four democratically appointed justices would have denied it. So that what that means is that the stay, that the Clean Power Plan rule would be stayed for proceedings, meaning that the Clean Power Plan rule would not be able to go into effect until the court proceedings had finished their way through the courts, either before the D.C. Circuit or more likely when it got before the Supreme Court, it would be finally decided by the court. So that does mean, in general, we were talking about potentially a couple years before the Clean Power Plan would be back in place or overturned if the Supreme Court decided to do so. Now, with the change in the court, where unfortunately the court now has a different composition. And right as of now, the Supreme Court only has 8 sitting justices before the court.
That's really the key there, isn't it? What the D.C. Circuit does. So we know that two of the judges on that panel are a George H.W. Bush appointee, Karen Henderson, and a Clinton appointee, Judith Rogers. They've been sympathetic to environmental claims in the past. But then we have this third judge who a lot of people have heard for the first time recently, Sri Srinivasan, who's a recent Obama appointee. He is also on this panel, and we don't really know much about him because he's both worked as a clerk for Sandra Day O'Connor and also Democratic judges as well. However, I think he's also been as a practicing attorney, he represented Jeff Skilling from Enron and has also worked for ExxonMobil. So he's kind of a wild card character in this. So give us the two scenarios if the D.C. Circuit either upholds it or votes it down, the Clean Power Plan.
Well, another sort of interesting wrinkle in the case is that As you mentioned, one of the sitting justices in the D.C. Circuit, Sri Srinivasan, is for some people on the short list of potential nominees to be the Supreme Court nominee. If he were to be such, that obviously adds a little bit of wrinkle to the D.C. Circuit case as well, because if he is nominated before they hear the case, then it's possible that the case that they would reassign a new judge to the case. And if that's the case, that would change the composition of the D.C. Circuit panel hearing the case. If he were nominated after hearing the case, it's possible that he would have to recuse himself if he was sitting on the Supreme Court when it went before the Clean Power Plan. And if that was the case, then we'd be back to the scenario of 8 sitting justices hearing the case. So, I mean, I don't know if that's a very likely scenario. I don't know I don't know what the odds are on the different potential nominees for the court. But that does add another potential wrinkle to the procedure for the Clean Power Plan review by the D.C. Circuit as well as the Supreme Court.
And if it doesn't go back to the Supreme Court, and let's say the D.C. Circuit does not side with the Clean Power Plan and does not uphold it, how do things play out in your estimation?
Well, if the D.C. Circuit decides to that the Clean Power Plan is either unconstitutional or illegal under the Clean Air Act, and the Supreme Court decides to deny review of the case, then the D.C. Circuit decision stands. And frankly, the D.C. Circuit decision would stand in any scenario where the Supreme Court decides not to grant what's called a writ of certiorari, so review of the case. And if that were the case, then the new administration, most likely, would have to figure out how they would want to proceed, whether they would want to, you know, modify the Clean Power Plan if they could, to comply with the Supreme Court decision, or do something else. Of course, it is also possible that if the new administration were to come into place and the Supreme Court hadn't decided the case yet, or the D.C. Circuit, for that matter, hadn't decided the case yet, the administration might choose, if it was not favorable to the Clean Power Plan, decide not to defend the case before the court or try to change the Clean Power Plan in some substantial way. That certainly has happened before, where a new administration has come into place while the case is pending for the Supreme Court and decide that they are not going to prosecute or defend a particular case before the Supreme Court because they have a change of viewpoint as to the appropriateness of that rule.
And what if the Obama administration is able to confirm a justice before November, but a Republican wins the White House in 2016? What can we expect in terms of the Clean Power Plan then? Would it be repealed?
Yes, I think there's a good possibility. I mean, I guess it depends. There's so much uncertainty and questions as to what exactly would involve that in that scenario. But I think it's fairly clear that a Republican administration would be less receptive to a comprehensive overhaul of the energy industry, and it's very possible that they would choose to either rescind the Clean Power Plan or make major changes in the power plan. Certainly, some of the different Republican presidential candidates have made a number of different claims regarding other forms of regulatory programs, whether we're talking about health care or talking about immigration, and I believe in environmental law as well, particularly to the Paris Agreement, that they would rescind application of that as soon as they were in office. So I suspect that, again, depending on the particular nominee, there's a very good possibility that they would scrap the Clean Power Plan or at least substantially modify it.
And I don't know if you can really comment on this, but it's, I think, one of the things that we're kind of missing is that the world needs to act now when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. That we can agree on. And the Clean Power Plan has been looked at by skeptics as too little too late. Under this scenario, with it getting tossed around in the courts, we could be in limbo with something like this when utilities actually have to invest now if they're going to get off of coal. Is the U.S. legislative and judicial system too glacial to be able to adapt to something like the Paris Agreement?
So it's certainly true that the U.S. Constitutional democracy system is intended to be a system that allows for, obviously, checks and balances and separation of powers. And certainly this type of democracy is not supposed to be fast. It's supposed to be just, if you will. It's certainly true that these sorts of decisions often end up taking a significant amount of time, and given the context of climate change, I mean, many of us are quite concerned about having to act as quickly as possible, that is certainly a problem. The D.C. Circuit did adopt a fairly aggressive schedule for itself in terms of hearing the case. Certainly, briefing is supposed to be done by April. The hearing is supposed to occur for the case sometime in early June. At least that's what it's calendared for. And so the fall, we expect would be in the fall that the decision would likely come down. But that is obviously not incredibly fast. That is why I think many observers of the Supreme Court and environmental lawyers in general were quite dismayed by the issuance of the stay, because even if the case is still pending, without the stay, the regulation stays in effect and all different parties are working hard to try to figure out compliance plans, even those who are skeptical or even suing in the current case. That being said, on the bright side, it's certainly true that a number of different states are moving forward with their voluntarily on their compliance plans, their implementation plans, and even states that are skeptical or sort of resistant to the application of the Clean Power Plan, even those who are suing it, are going to have to weigh their options about whether they still might want to, in a parallel track, come up with craft a plan to meet the Clean Power Plan possibility that the Supreme Court does uphold the Clean Power Plan, and they will have to, on an accelerated basis, come with a way to meet all the requirements of the plan. So there is certainly a possibility. Many different regulators are going to be still scrambling to try to implement the Clean Power Plan, but there's no doubt that the stay does tilt the analysis of those who are thinking about compliance away from doing so and towards maybe more recalcitrance or waiting and seeing how the things shake out.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Alex Camacho. He is a professor of law at the University of California at Irvine. Just last year, the Supreme Court overturned the EPA on air pollution when it came to mercury. And Michigan versus EPA from a couple years ago that is talking about that the costs of the plants would have to be balanced with the cost to the public when it came to mercury emissions. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, right. The EPA was making the determination that it was appropriate to regulate power plants. The section of the Clean Air Act was EPA is required to regulate power plants when it's appropriate and necessary. The Supreme Court held that the EPA's interpretation of that was unreasonable when it refused to consider the costs, certain costs, when making that decision.
So the Clean Air Act is kind of a very amorphous document for the Supreme Court and the EPA to be basing policy on, because the original drafting doesn't have anything to do with carbon, for example.
Right. So the way that the Clean Air Act is drafted it's a long statute. So it has some detail, but of course it's also leaves things in some ways general. The statute allows the agency the authority to regulate certain pollutants that are identified as pollutants in the statute, but it also includes language that if anything is a certain type of pollutant, an air pollutant, it can also be regulated in the future. So any kind of air pollutant might be subject to the regimes of the Clean Air Act. So in order to make that, what's required for that to occur, the agency needs to make some sort of what's called typically an endangerment finding, essentially finding that this pollutant would endanger public health or welfare, and as a result then has the opportunity to regulate under the Clean Air Act. Somewhat ironically, or at least as a part of the history here, a very famous Supreme Court case, Massachusetts versus EPA, of a while ago, under the second Bush administration, the Bush administration had refused to regulate greenhouse gases, and they had two different reasons for doing so. First of all, they said that the statute doesn't allow them to regulate greenhouse gases or particular CO2, but that even if it did have the authority to do so, it was choosing not to do so. And the Supreme Court overturned that and said, in fact, it did have the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases. And although the administration could choose not to regulate greenhouse gases in its discretion, it had to give certain reasons for doing so, and those reasons could not be purely political, like the ones it was providing. They needed to provide reasoned explanations for why there was either so much uncertainty, and that was why they weren't regulating, although the Supreme Court raised skepticism that uncertainty was there, or it gave some sort of other sort of direct reasons for not regulating, other than that it was politically inexpedient, that there had to be certain particular reasons for doing so. So the Supreme Court actually, in many ways, told the EPA, yeah, you need to go ahead and give us at least a better reason for why you're not going to regulate greenhouse gases. Subsequent to that point, the administration changed. It became the new president took over, and under the Obama administration, they did find it. They did make the endangerment finding, and then moved forward with a series of regulations that first started regulating mobile sources, auto emissions, as well as fuel standards. And then moving towards new stationary sources, new power plants, and then sort of culminating with this the latest sort of substantial regulation under the Clean Power Plan.
So, Alex, it would seem like the Supreme Court or any court trying to issue a fair ruling both to utilities and to the public has to find this very delicate balance between allowing states some kind of autonomy and also protecting the public health, regardless of what side of a state line you might live on. And when we're talking about air pollution, it's obviously a global issue. Forget about states' rights. This is the air we all breathe. So how can a jurist approach this in a prudent way?
This has been raised before, that the Clean Air Act is, in some sense, an unusual fit for dealing with globalized air pollution, at least sort of the core program that I mentioned before, the cooperative federalism program, is a bit of an odd fit where the federal government sets goals and states end up implementing it. And in fact, there are portions of the statute that deal directly with globalized problems. The Montreal Protocol, which deals with chlorofluorocarbons, it's an international agreement, was adopted as a separate part of the Clean Air Act, seen as sort of a separate regime than the sort of the typical, what we would call the sort of cooperative federalism, NAAQS, or National Ambient Air Quality Standards Program, combined with the state implementation program. But that being said, the statute has been incredibly nimble in many ways. It's a statute that does regulate auto emissions differently as a national program. It does regulate pollutants internationally, but the Supreme Court and others have interpreted the statute as allowing for regulation, even for very sort of easily dispersed pollutants, through this sort of federal goal, state implementation approach. And so I think many people, even proponents, environmentalists, proponents of EPA acting in this way under the Clean Air Act, would agree that in some sense it would be ideal to create a separate standalone comprehensive regime for dealing with climate change, similar to what we saw under the Montreal Protocol and its implementation into the statute as a separate program. But the administration has made a fairly reasonable decision that absent the Congress creating such a separate regime, it has sufficient authority to address these sorts of problems through the means that the Congress gave the administration or gave the president decades ago when it created the Clean Air Act. So it's moving forward in that regard, but I think many would agree that it would be in some ways better for to create a separate program that would sort of address climate change in a more comprehensive way than a sort of state-by-state approach.
And that brings us to the Paris Agreement. What does this ruling mean for not only the United States' involvement in the agreement, but what does it mean for the balance of the agreement itself, in your opinion?
I think it's fair to say that it's politically problematic internationally. I mean, the administration pointed to the Clean Power Plan, as I mentioned before, as sort of its core sort of linchpin program for addressing climate change policy. And it did it before the Paris talks, and it certainly did it during the Paris talks and afterwards as well. So it's certainly something that the administration has said, this is a core program that we are relying on to meet our obligations and our commitments. And now it does raise the question about whether at least in the interim, if not longer term, whether the Clean Power Plan will actually be there, at least in the same iteration that it was when it was adopted initially. That being said, it's fair to say that the United States' ability, so its relationship to its Paris, to the pledges it made in the Paris talks, the Paris Agreement, they do not completely hinge on the Clean Power Plan. In part because what was required under the federal government, the United States government agreed to, what it submitted as its what they call the sort of intended nationally determined contribution under the Paris Agreement, would require a lot more than what the Clean Power Plan actually provides for. And in fact, the administration, in sort of a workup and explaining why it came up with its contribution, did sort of point to the fact that the Clean Power Plan reductions would not meet its obligations. Let me be more specific. The administration under the Paris Agreement said that its goal was to achieve a 17% reduction below 2005 levels in 2020. That was their goal, the 70% reduction below 2005 levels in 2020. They also added another pledge of a 26% to around 28% reduction by 2025. The Clean Power Plan reductions do not begin until 2022. There's a lot of planning that needs to be done before then. The states submit their plans. The federal government approves them or doesn't approve them. They go back. But of course, if the Clean Power Plan reductions aren't supposed to begin until 2022, obviously they cannot be helpful to achieve that first sort of goal mentioned in the Paris Agreement, which is supposed to occur by 2020. But so the administration points out that a number of different things need to occur in addition to the Clean Power Plan. Things like fuel economy standards, efficiency standards in a variety of different sectors, some state actions that are going to occur. And when the administration explained its obligations or how it was going to meet its obligations under the Paris Agreement, it does point to the Clean Power Plan, undoubtedly. And so this would be a blow to its portfolio, if you will, of approaches to addressing the Paris Agreement. But it does point to other things that the administration has done and is planning on doing, and hopefully expects the government to continue to do with regard to other greenhouse gas emissions, like methane. So that there are other actions that would have to occur. So there's clearly a relationship between the Paris Agreement and the Clean Power Plan, but it's not as simple an answer as now this sort of throws the entire thing up in the air. What it does do politically, of course, is that when the administration has said in the past that we are strongly committed to addressing greenhouse gases, and this is a core program of our action, the fact that another branch of the government has raised some questions about it does cause political problems, if not raise the sort of broader lesson, I think you might say, to climate change advocates or advocates of taking action of towards climate change, that there's a whole portfolio of actions that need to occur, clean power being a core one, but that we need to be thinking much more broadly about the other actions that need to occur domestically to meet our goals and to obviously to do even go beyond that to address global climate change.
Billy Dalton staggered on the sidewalk. Someone said he stumbled and he fell. Six squad cars came screaming to the rescue. Hauled old Billy Dalton off to jail. 'Cause the law is for protection of the people. Rules are rules and any fool can see. We don't need no drunks like Billy Dalton scaring decent folks like you and me. No siree. Homely Honeycutt was nothing but a hippie.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Alex Camacho. He is a professor of law at the University of California at Irvine. It would seem to imperil the leverage of any U.S. president engaged in a global treaty like the Paris Agreement. I mean, if you were one of the other countries negotiating this and had to keep in the back of your mind that, yeah, the largest actor in this scenario could just be upended by one Supreme Court justice like Anthony Kennedy, it's almost saying that the president does not have that the executive branch doesn't really have the authority to legislate treaties of this ilk.
This is not a treaty. The Paris Agreement is not a formal treaty which requires the advice and consent of the Senate. But it is certainly true that the way our Constitution is designed, the president does have the authority to talk on behalf of the federal government, on behalf of the United States of America. But on the other hand, you know, the legislature is supposed to still play a role. And, of course, the courts do still play a role in interpreting statutes as well as international instruments in its approach. So it's no doubt that the United States does have a regulatory design, a constitutional design that is, in many ways, you might say, is intended to be messy.
But messy and slow. And when we're talking about global greenhouse emissions, we don't have the time necessarily to go through a multi-decade process to legislate something like this.
That's certainly true. And I think climate change is definitely, it's probably the largest test that democracy has had globally, but certainly it's one of the largest tests that our particular form of constitutional democracy has, where it's much more focused on short-term problems and makes large change very difficult to occur. It's much more of a sort of, it promotes stasis, if you will, when you're talking about a problem that requires long-term vision. And so that combination of a democratic sort of short-termism with and slowness of the regulatory sort of approach, the institutional design, with some sort of a long-term problem like climate change, it really does raise major questions. There is reason to hope, even with the stay, that things aren't as bad as, you know, there is an argument to be made for why things aren't as bad as they may seem. The stay itself is not necessarily a statement that, in fact, that the statute will be overturned. Even if they did strike down portions of the Clean Power Plan, it depends on what portions of the plan we're talking about. But other parts might still survive depending on the reasoning of the decision. So we would have to wait and see what happens in that sense.
Alex Camacho, thank you so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Sure, thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Ernest Ranglin, Bob Marley and the Wailers, and Chris Christofferson.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.